Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Trading 212. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, the flying FTSE is on course for the best start to the year since 1998. But what are we buying? Zooming in on Rolls-Royce, shares have soared over 1,000% in 5 years. Is it too late to join the party? Also today, what do kids do with their junior ISAs when they turn 18? NS&I cuts the premium bond prize rate again. We look at the government's making tax digital. Is expensive chaos on the way? And would you really save money with an EV? Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, as Simon mentioned last week with his stat of the week, the FTSE 100 has been on something of a tear-up this year. In fact, the London stock market is enjoying its best start to the year for nearly three decades as it closes in on the 11,000 mark. The gains so far this year are 8.8%. It's been helped by the Tasty 20, the stocks that have all gone up over 50%. But before we get there, Simon, just a reminder, why the rise? And also, I'm curious, what happened in 1998?
In 1998, something called the dot-com boom was just getting a bit of a run-up and starting to move into full swing. That was mainly a US phenomenon, but markets were riding high and doing well. The country was riding a wave of optimism in the UK, fueled by a new Labour government. And Cool Britannia, this was peak Cool Britannia years. Labour were elected in 97. The economy started picking up. Largely, actually, you know, one of the things this is connected to is that the sort of early to mid-90s years had been really quite miserable economically. We'd seen the really bad recession at the start of the 90s. We had seen the housing market as well really suffered. It's actually hard for us to think about now because every time the housing market has suffered since the financial crisis, we've propped it up. But back then, we didn't prop it up in the same way. That was starting to rebound. And so you had this uptick that was going on. And sometimes you just get good years for the stock market. And sometimes it doesn't even rhyme with, you know, what's going on in the general mood in the country. If you look at last year was a fantastic year for the FTSE 100. It delivered a total return of 25%. I wouldn't necessarily say last year was a fantastic mood for the economy or sentiment amongst British business or consumers.
Yeah, quite. The first question?
Oh, yeah, the first question. was that...
The subject of our conversation.
Why is it going up?
Yeah. Why the rise, Simon?
And long-time podcast listeners are going to be hugely disappointed that I went back in time without doing the...
It's true.
Build up or making a
DeLorean. It's not too late, Simon.
Or cracking the usual DeLorean joke. Anyway, I've got both those mentions in. So if you're playing This Is Money podcast bingo, you can tick those two off. Right. Why is the stock market going up?
Yes.
This is something that we have also been talking about for some time. The reason why the UK stock market is going up is, well, there's a number of reasons. One, actually, compared to the US stock market and some other markets, it's pretty cheap. The UK stock market has been unloved for some time. The FTSE 100, which is what we're talking about, that's the part of the market that's been doing really, really well. And if you look at the UK stock market, you can divide it into different chunks. You've got the FTSE 100, that's the 100 biggest UK listed companies by market value. Then you've got the FTSE 250, which is the next 250 down. And then you go below that, and you get the rest of the FTSE All Share, and then you've got the small cap indices and AIM, which is the junior market. So the broad measure of the UK stock market that's usually used is actually something called the FTSE All Share. We focus a lot of attention on the FTSE 100, which is the top 100 companies. And actually, the top 100 companies make up such a big chunk of the All Share that it's a reasonable read across between the two. But the FTSE 250 below it, which is what's considered the mid-cap stocks, the more medium-sized companies, those are considered to be more domestically focused, whereas the FTSE 100 is considered to be more internationally focused. Regardless of which, it has been seen as old hat. Everyone's been buying into big US tech, AI, exciting stories, and they have not been buying into the old-fashioned industries that the UK is seen as having in its top stock market index. So financials, you know, banks and insurers, miners, energy companies. Like, yeah, who wants that? I want Nvidia, Apple, Tesla, exciting stuff. Anyway, turns out you can have too much of a good thing. And with the Magnificent Seven and the US stock market absolutely rampaging ahead, concerns over valuation and also taking up so much of the global stock market that the US stock market now accounts for about 70% of some of the global stock market indices, attention has started to shift elsewhere. And attention has started to shift to better value stock markets and also, interestingly, to some old-fashioned companies. There is, interestingly, what's going on with this whole sort of next chapter of the AI story is people are now looking at real stuff and investing in real stuff, whether that's miners who are digging real stuff out of the ground, whether that is engineers like Rolls-Royce, BAE, who are making real stuff, and BAE is benefiting from the defense spending boom. Banks, I'm not sure you can say banks make real stuff, but they do lend money into the real economy. So anyway, and you know, it's cheap. And the other element is that there's so much money that has gone into the US stock market and into those giant companies in the US stock market that it doesn't take much for when some of that starts to shift away to drive up other stock markets elsewhere. Nvidia is worth more than the whole UK stock market. So it doesn't have to be that everybody stops buying Nvidia, everybody stops buying Microsoft, everybody stops buying Amazon and Apple. All it needs to be is just a little bit of that money starts to get diverted elsewhere, and it can have a serious effect. And then investors start to see these things going up and they go, ooh, that looks good. That's going up. And you get more attention and more interest and demand goes up and you start to see momentum building. And for the first time in a really long time, the FTSE is looking like it's got a bit of momentum. What's happened previously is it'll have a good year and then it just completely lose momentum. It's like trying to jumpstart a faulty car. It's not working. And so on. And you know, one of the best years the FTSE had prior to last year was when it beat the other markets, but it beat them by not falling as much. It basically was flat when the others fell. Whereas now, last year and this year, things are looking pretty good.
They are indeed. And like you say, it's something we've been saying for a long time. Is this the year? Is this the year? So could this, Lee, be the year? Or is it just another little flirtation?
I'm not too sure about that. I mean, the FTSE 100 is a massively international index. When you look at it and the makeup of it. One thing's for sure, though, I think that, as Simon was saying there, it's back in fashion because of the defensive nature, I think, of the FTSE 100 versus, you know, you could argue inflated valuations of technology stocks, especially in the US. I mean, some of the figures are just absolutely mind-bending how much these companies are actually worth. When you look at the Tasty 20, that we've labelled them here, the 20 companies that have gone up more than 50% in the last year. Simon's outlining quite a lot of them there. The list is led by Fresnillo, which is a miner. It's up 448%, which is absolutely astronomical. But there's some really familiar names in here for everyday British people. We're going to talk about Rolls-Royce in a minute, but that's up 116%. You've got companies like Vodafone, it's up 70%, Barclays 54%, Lloyd's 52%. You know, they're companies that people, they know. But there are also some companies in there that, you know, I was like, I've not even heard of that company. So yeah. Airtel Africa. It's third in the list.
Which means you've not heard of Airtel Africa, Lee?
I've not heard of Airtel Africa when we were looking through this list. 149%, that's up. But obviously, wow. It doesn't have much of a UK presence. It's, Africa. But that's the nature of the FTSE. It's very international, which is what I was trying to say. We look at where it's come from, where it's gone, though, the level. So, you know, at time of recording of this, we're hovering around 10,900 at FTSE 100. It's gone on an absolute tear up. So far this year, you only have to go back to April. It sunk as low as 7,544, which was the Donald Trump Liberation Day tariff blitz that kind of sort of hit markets. I mean, we're hovering at almost 11,000. It felt like just yesterday it was going past the 10,000 milestone. And the other thing to point out here as well is that it's benefiting from sterling weakness. So 80% of blue chip revenues, you know, they come from overseas. So they're boost profits when they're converted back into pounds. So there's a lot going on. It's a very international flavored market, the FTSE 100. But I do think that, as Simon said, there's just quite a bit of overspill of money pouring into what has been, you know, quite an unloved market. And people going, maybe we are just too heavily weighted on the Magnificent Seven. You know, Mag Seven have had so much coverage and so much money pour into them. You know, do they offer value still? Are they going to keep on the trajectory? And I think that's what's been on the forefront of a lot of investors' minds.
Is it, Simon, though, too late to get involved in this particular party? And if you'd like to, what's the best way to increase your exposure to the UK if you are feeling a bit uncomfortable with US and AI dominance?
I mean, it's not necessarily too late. What I would say about those companies that we've got in our Tasty 20 is that they have gone up by a lot over the last year. But many of them are still considered to potentially be relatively undervalued. Some of them are not. Rolls-Royce, which we're going to talk about in a minute, is trading on a very high valuation. It's actually valued more highly than Nvidia at the moment, interestingly. BAE is trading on a reasonably high valuation, certainly compared to where it has been in the past. Obviously, it's benefiting from all that defence spending that's going on and the need to do more defence spending. But everybody knows about that. So is that already in the price? Some of the others, for example, maybe Lloyds Bank, GSK, they're considered to still be relatively inexpensive. I think with anything like this, if you watch something go up by a lot and then you try to jump on that wagon, then you need to be careful. Okay, because momentum can continue for quite some time, but momentum can also suddenly stop. And what you need to be doing is spreading your risk and diversifying. So the worst thing you could possibly do is just basically buy the one company at the top of this list, which is Fresnillo, which has gone up by 448% in the last year. So Fresnillo has gone up by so much because it's a miner. And obviously gold and silver prices have gone through the roof. Endeavour Mining is in second position. Antofagasta, another miner, in fourth position. But what you could do, you know, you could very easily, actually, using some of the investment apps that you can get nowadays that offer you commission-free trading. So Trading 212, sponsor of this podcast, right? If you have a Trading 212 app, you can invest in the stock market with no account fees and no dealing fees. So you could very easily take some money and you could split it between all 20 of these companies. And then you would be diversified. You would have a diversified portfolio. It would be across quite a few different industries, ones that have been doing very well recently, but it would be across quite a few different industries. You'd have mining, telecoms, engineering, energy, banks and financials, industrials, healthcare. That's a reasonable spread, right? And it's pretty much what the FTSE, does, right? But you could just buy these 20 and you could have build your own portfolio. Or you could do the easy thing and you could buy a FTSE 100 tracker or buy a FTSE All Share tracker. And then you don't have to do any of that work. You let the computer do it for you and the market do the deciding for you. You won't beat the market, but you won't fall behind the market because there's every chance that, you know, if you buy these 20 in here, they could continue to do better and you beat the market. But it is also the chance that if you buy these 20 in here, they fall behind the market and actually you do worse. The other thing I would think about is potentially the FTSE 250, the mid caps. Now, there's a number of fund managers that I've spoken to who are saying that the value now lies further down the scale in the mid caps and in some of the small cap companies, which are still very much underappreciated by investors. And some of them are, you know, making lots of profits, sitting on big cash piles, and still trading on really lowly price to earnings ratios, which is a measure of how expensive a company is, basically. Its share price compared to how much earnings that share price is entitled to. And that potentially they've got more of a run-up for future gains than some of these big FTSE 100 stocks that have already made the bumper returns.
All right, then. Simon, you said we were going to talk about Rolls-Royce. Let's go there now, because share prices rocketed 1,178% in 5 years, and the British engineering powerhouse's bumper results last week sent them up again. So, Lee, can the shares continue their incredible run, or if you're lucky enough already to own them, is now the time to sort of cut and run, basically? And if so, where else should you invest? But before we get there, this is not the car, right?
No, this is not the car. Which I wish some of our people that publish sometimes realise that when they start throwing in pictures of the cars. No, it is not the cars. It's largely, you know, industry in terms of engine making. Think aeroplanes and that type of thing. The run that Rolls-Royce has had since the pandemic is absolutely incredible. I mean, that figure that you just banded there is absolutely astronomical. It's now the best performing blue chip. It's got £116 billion valuation. It's absolutely astronomical, the turnaround. And if you'd invested in that 2020 slump, you'd be sitting incredibly pretty today. I mean, it was near bankrupted, I think I'm right in saying, in the pandemic. You know, it was incredible. You know, it's impressive what it's done, because, you know, there was let's not forget the post-pandemic shortage of spare parts, components, all of that kind of stuff. It was a massive problem. And it's had the turnaround has been largely thanks, well, not largely, but a big part of it to Turkish-born boss Tufan. And I'm not going to try and pronounce his surname. We could just call him Turbo Tufan, because that's what he's referred to. I don't want to do a disservice trying to pronounce his surname on this show. But he has managed to really kind of steer this even further. And, you know, we've got things like worries over defence and that kind of thing that Rolls-Royce are in kind of part with, and they've got the contract for next generation of small modular nuclear reactors. They're going to be built potentially around the UK. There's lots of things going on with Rolls-Royce that make it still potentially a good buy, but, you know, who knows what's around the corner. But it's got 150,000 small shareholders stuck through the company through thick and thin. It was privatized under Thatcher in 1987. And younger investors are also got into the party. You know, Trading 212 actually is saying that, you know, it's been very popular with the younger generation as well. And I think part of that is because it is such a familiar name. I think
I was going to say, because they think it's the car.
Because they think it's the car. Yeah, quite possibly. Its growth prospects are said to be far better than a lot of blue chip peers, and upgraded forecasts from this week appear to sort of back that up. I'm not going to make any kind of crazy suggestions here of where the Rolls-Royce share price goes next, because you look at it on a chart and you think, I mean, how much more can that line continue to go up? But there are other options. I think Simon probably best placed to tell you what the other options potentially are of Rolls-Royce. But a real potted kind of last 5-6 years history of just how far the share price has gone.
I mean, it's an interesting story, isn't it, Simon? And it's an interesting, I suppose, conundrum if you are one of those people who got in early and have benefited from such a stonking rise. But it also makes me think generally a lesson on, if you have a stock in your portfolio that has been on a bit of a tear up, what should you be thinking about for your next move? But before we get that, Rolls-Royce, the party, is it going to continue? Are the fundamentals rock solid and therefore it's just going to keep on going, Simon? Or is it time to sort of cut a little bit and, you know, invest somewhere else? And if you do, where?
Well, look, this is a very difficult one to call. Okay, because Rolls-Royce shares, as Lee flagged, have gone up by an astonishing amount. For example, if you had invested £1,000 into Rolls-Royce 5 years ago, you would now have £13,000. If you had invested £1,000 into NVIDIA 5 years ago, you would have more, but you'd have £14,000. That illustrates quite how much that Rolls-Royce share price has gone up by. It's gone up by nearly as much as NVIDIA, okay? Which is pretty astonishing when you consider how much NVIDIA has gone up in value. What is also interesting, as I alluded to earlier, is that it is now more highly valued than NVIDIA. And it came out with some astonishing figures yesterday So, for example, Rolls-Royce predicted that its profits are going to go up substantially, that it is going to get involved in a up to £9 billion buyback, which helps push up the share price further, because by buying back shares, you reduce the number of shares in the market, and therefore then that lack of supply, if it meets demand, should drive up the share price. It's also very good for corporate executives because it helps boost the share price and they like that, and often their bonuses are tied to it. So it is going to do £2.5 billion worth of buybacks this year. It is not just involved in aerospace engineering. It is involved in defence, but it is also involved in power and energy. Mm. And that is one of the really big issues that we have at the moment. So there's two things. It's making a lot of money from the providing the power for AI data centers, and it thinks that there's going to be a lot more money in this, because the problem with these data centers is that they use unbelievable amounts of energy. And this is probably where the data center thing and the AI thing is eventually going to run up and hit a brick wall, is that the amount of energy you need to power these data centers that are allegedly all going to be built has to come from somewhere. And if it's coming from the same place that the energy we're using to power our homes and businesses comes from, then it's going to send the cost of powering our homes and businesses through the absolute roof. So somebody's going to have to work out what to do. And the other thing is the next generation of small modular nuclear reactors.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, these are basically a new and untested technology aimed at producing nuclear power stations in factories at lower cost and higher installation speeds. Our government is pumping $2.5 billion into the project, which reduces the risk for Rolls-Royce shareholders and provides some backing for it. But also, you've got to remember that if this is happening here, this is happening around the world, and Rolls-Royce is considered to be at the forefront of this stuff. So if Rolls-Royce is successful with those, then actually, you know, it could have potentially a much bigger runway for its profits. Also then, if you look at the size of Rolls-Royce, I think it's roughly about 116 billion valuation earlier this week. It's gone up a bit since the results. It's fifth biggest company on the UK stock market. I mean, it could get bigger. Like, if that, you could see a scenario where Rolls-Royce gets bigger. Certainly when you compare it to the valuations put on some of the US tech companies and the size of those US tech companies, you could see how something like Rolls-Royce could get bigger. But as you said, a lot of those gains have been made. And it is very, very highly rated, PE ratio of 40, higher than Nvidia. You know, can that continue? But I can tell you a story about holding on to shares in Rolls-Royce. Do you want to know a story about that?
I do, and then I'm going to ask you a few investing 101 terminologies, so you can have that to look forward to, Simon.
Right. I bought some Rolls-Royce shares in the pandemic. I looked it up earlier.
I remember you did.
Yeah, on the 29th of September 2021, I bought £5,000 worth of Rolls-Royce shares. I'll tell you how much I bought. At £1.42. Now, in theory, I'd be sitting on a lot of money right now. Unfortunately,
we know where this story's
going. Yeah, yeah. I sold those Rolls-Royce shares before.
Right.
Before.
Why?
Right. So, what happened was, okay, and this illustrates something that investors need to understand, is this was not all plain sailing, okay? I bought Rolls-Royce shares. The reason why I bought Rolls-Royce shares is because I was sitting on some money at the time, because we were sitting on money to then do work on our house. And I did what you shouldn't do. I invested money that I was going to need in the short term. So first of all, you shouldn't do that, but I did do it. And I took a calculated risk on it. And there was a number of companies that I bought individual shares in because I thought that at the time they were effectively being priced for going bust. And they might go bust, but the furthest you can go is zero, right? Mm-hmm. But the upside of companies that are quite often priced for pretty much for going bust can be really quite big, especially with some of these big companies. And we've seen this before with big companies where everybody's completely written them off and then they do bounce back. They don't always bounce back. Some of them do actually just fade away. Anyway, a year later, my investment in Rolls-Royce was worth 50% of the money I'd put in. Those shares went down from September 2021. By September 2022, they hit a low point of about 70p. There were a number of occasions over that time where I thought I had made a serious mistake, and I very nearly sold out of those shares at a loss and cut my losses and went, they're down 50%. You know, I'm never going to make that money back. I should just take the money out of my investment. I should just sell and I should buy something else. You made a bad decision. You got it wrong. I didn't. I held on. Often, sometimes just through a mix of kind of inertia and being busy and procrastinating.
Life.
Yeah, exactly. By the time I sold them at the start of January 2024, they'd gone up to about 300p. So I'd made a really healthy gain on those. And it was at this point when we were having to pay the final bills for the work that we'd done on the house, and I needed that money. And I was like, great, okay, you know, I've got the money there. But I was getting really twitchy about the market taking a tumble or me losing it. So I had trailing stop losses running on some of those investments, including Rolls Royce, and they were quite tight because I was like, I don't even want to lose, you know, 500 quid, £1,000 for this, because I've got these bills and I need to pay them. There was a stock market wobble at the start of 2024, and I got stopped out of Rolls Royce at just over 300p. So it was great. I took the money. I was like, brilliant. But I do remember thinking at the time, maybe I should reinvest some money in from somewhere else. I should take some money out of one of my other investments and buy some Rolls Royce shares again, because actually I do think there is more to come from Rolls Royce. But what I was doing was I was thinking the price will come down. I'll wait for the price to come down a bit. Mm. I'll wait for the price to come down a bit. And at one point it did, and I didn't do it. And then it just went up. Within a year, it had doubled. They were now worth 600p. And a year later, pretty much, you know, it's just after a year later now, February 2026, they've more than doubled again. So there you go. Just goes to show that sometimes you should run your winners. But when you've made that money, you anchor on the money that you've made and you're like, ooh, do I really want to? So yeah, it's a difficult decision to make.
It is a difficult decision to make. And there will be a lot of people sort of looking at their portfolios thinking that there might be individual stocks that have moved in to become quite dominant. I've got one myself, SLB Limited, Schlumberger as was, which is now taking up about 7% of my portfolio. What should I be doing? I know you're not a financial advisor, but there were lots of people in this position. If they do think, you know, I'm going to take a little bit from Rolls-Royce, where would you go next? What would you do?
Well, sometimes the advice on this can be confusing because on one hand, you're told to run your winners and cut your losers. And on the other hand, you're told to, you know, take some profits and top slice some of your winners. I mean, what you can do, and one thing that some people recommend, Richard Hunter, you know, longtime markets commentator, often says this to me, the thing to do is to basically take the money that you paid for the shares or paid for the investment out and then everything you've got in there is for free. And Lee does this as well, I know. If you've made a load of money, you just take out the initial cost of the investment and then whatever happens, it's all there for free. What you can do, for example, in your position is if you go, right, well, I think 7% of my portfolio for one individual company is too much, is you could sell some of it, reinvest some of the rest of it into other investments that you have if you think they're still worth buying. And then you reduce the size of it in your portfolio, which is the thing that quite often gets recommended in terms of spring cleaning portfolios. But then, as I said, you're not running your winners in the same way that you get told to run your winners. So I think what you need to do is you need to look at something and go, is this now such a large part of my portfolio that if something bad happened to it, it would cause me a problem or it might cause me to react in a bad way? And if so, then you need to do something about it.
Now I'm a bit like you, Simon. I'm sort of, yeah, maybe I'll do something about it. Maybe I'll do something about it. Dear reader, she won't do anything about it. Simon, just a couple of things you said, which I just wanted to get a bit of a 101 on. You talked about share buybacks and you talk about PE ratio.
A price to earnings ratio is basically the investment industry's benchmark valuation method. It's how you decide how expensive a company or a market is. And you take the share price and you divide it by earnings per share and it gives you a number. And it basically tells you how much profits that individual share is entitled to. A low number indicates cheaper, a high number indicates more expensive, but you need to compare them to similar companies in similar industries and sectors, rather than, for example, comparing one type of company to another type of company. So Tesco, which is a supermarket, supermarkets tend to trade on quite low price to earnings valuations. So you can't compare Tesco's PE to Nvidia's PE, for example. And then what was the other question?
Share buyback. You mentioned that relation to Rolls-Royce.
Right. Companies have two main ways of returning money to shareholders, one of which is paying dividends, which is when they basically pay you a certain amount for each share that you hold, and it's a way of rewarding shareholders. Another way is share buybacks, where instead they buy shares back from investors. Sometimes they'll buy them back and then hold the shares themselves in their own treasury, but quite often they buy the shares back and then they cancel the shares. That reduces the total number of shares in existence and tends to drive up the share price.
Brilliant. Simon, thank you very much. Our own Investopedia, Simon Lambert. Lee, thank you for being so patient there. We're going to talk about, well, something that's quite relevant to you being a parent. A lot of the time when we talk about junior ISAs, the big warning is, yeah, you do realise your kids get the money at 18 and they're just going to spank it. And it turns out that obviously some will do, but probably not as many as we might fear. According to some research by AJ Bell, they took a look at their customers. I assume it's all aggregate data. They didn't literally look at the customers, but and found out only 1 in 20 absolutely clean out their junior ISAs when they gain full control. And of course, we don't know. That could be for something very sensible, like buying a car or going to uni or whatever. But before we get into some of the detail of that, Lee, just give us a quick reminder, junior ISAs, the rules, the pitfalls.
Yeah, in a nutshell, junior ISA gives a £9,000 limit for under 18s that you can save into over the course of those 18 years. They can take control, or they take control of that junior ISA at the age of 16. They can't make a withdrawal until they're 18. And they're the crucial parts to know. You can have a cash junior ISA or you can have a stocks and shares junior ISA. The argument is because it's potentially over that 18-year period, probably going to be over at least a 10-year period, the investment route is probably the better route because you've got time for compound growth and gains and all that kind of stuff and the smoothing out of any stock market wobbles. But you're right, the big pitfall and what people wrestle with is when the children grow up, they've gone through their toddler phase, they've gone through the primary school phase, then they turn into the sort of grumpy teenager phase, and then they turn into that kind of like reckless, well, there's a bit of a broad, maybe I'm just talking about myself here, a bit of a sweeping brush, a reckless 16 to 18 year old who, you know, might get a bit of money and think, whoa, we're going to spend this on some absolute nonsense. I actually think, though, that we are becoming a nation better at talking about money. And I think that perhaps a lot more children are more clued up than what we kind of give them credit for after I've just sweepingly brushed 16 to 18 year olds.
But you're making a comparison between what we were like, and you're absolutely right. It's a different generation.
Potentially. I mean, I don't remember ever having a conversation about money before turning 18 with anyone in my family.
Can I have some money, please?
Yeah, and can you come and pick me up from here, and then being told how much the petrol costs and all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
I'm not a taxi driver.
Yeah. But this data from AJ Bell, I think, is encouraging. So I think the takeaway from it is that a third of young people with junior ISAs contribute into the ISA once it matures into an adult ISA. So the limit goes up from £9,000 to £20,000. I would suspect that most young adults aren't going to be filling that out. But looking at 3 years worth of customer data, to suggest that a third, to show that a third of young adults are taking on these junior ISAs into the adult ISA and continuing to put money into it, I think is encouraging. And it's that kind of like cornerstone, and knowing that that ISA is there. And yeah, sure, look, the first probably 3, 5, 10 years of having that ISA, you're probably not going to be contributing a whole lot, because you're not going to be earning much probably, and also cost of living, cost of accommodation if you've actually managed to move out of your parents, all those kind of things mean there's not that much spare money, funny enough, to go and put into your tax-free ISA. But Yeah, the stats are pretty strong. One in 10, though, take out more than half of the money within the first year, and one in 5 make a withdrawal of some amount during this period, but only around about one in 20 young savers empty their junior ISAs when they gain full control of the fund at 18. Now, as you say, that could be for a whole host of reasons, and people do save for a whole host of reasons. We also don't have the monetary data on this. So, you know, we could say that one in 20 empty their junior ISAs, but that ISA might only have, you know, a few hundred pounds in it or whatnot. So it's kind of hard to really quantify. But a lot of people do save into those tax-free junior ISAs. Grandparents, relatives encourage it because it could be for driving lessons, you know, when you're 18. Expensive learning to drive. It's a very expensive endeavor. If there's some money tucked away to be able to use it to do that, brilliant. Some people have probably gone more extreme than that and managed to save a few thousand pounds a year for their children, perhaps by themselves or perhaps with grandparents' help or other relatives' help. And they use that to pay a big chunk of going to university. And obviously, university has been in the news lots in the last couple of months because of you know, the high cost of student debt and young adults, you know, being saddled with effectively a lot of money or interest that builds up hugely in order to get a degree. But I think it's really interesting. But there's still that debate of, if you are saving for your child, where do you save for your child? You know, do you put it in a junior ISA? Do you put it in your own ISA wrapper if you're worried about what they're going to do with the money and you want more control over it? The one thing I would definitely say, though, is however you choose to do it, just make sure you do it and you don't sit on your twiddle your thumbs and just get on with it earlier the better. And Simon and I were talking about this in the office the other day, because you shouldn't be put off, even if like a younger member of your family, so your child is 10 and you haven't opened a junior ISA for them or done anything. It's not too late. That's still another 8 years of contributions that you can put in there. And we get a lot of questions from grandparents. You know, you have your £3,000 annual gifting allowance. Not a bad place to stick it if you want to help your grandchildren out and you've got the means to do so. And the gifting out of regular income. You know, also plenty of space in that £9,000 junior ISA wrapper to be making some regular gifts in there. You add all of that up, and you know, I'm a big advocate for trying to give young adults a boost up when they hit that age, by saving small and regular over the course of potentially 18 years, because it really does add up.
I think this whole student loan debate is, to me, with someone with no kids, but just highlighted just how vitally important it is, if you can, to really think about your kids and saving for them from a young age.
You see this, Georgia, this is the can of worms. I've opened it.
Yeah.
You're kind of singing into it. Now we're closing the can of worms.
Absolutely. I'm not going on that debate, but I was just thinking about
exactly what you mean.
Just the fact that there's so many costs for kids nowadays, and it's not just student loans. I mean, they might not want to go to uni, but, you know, driving lessons you just mentioned there's so much. One thing I do want to talk about, because it is a bit of a grandparent's favourite when it comes to kids, is premium bonds. Lee, bad news for savers this week, as Ennis and I made it even harder to win. Just explain to us what's changed. And look, every time we talk about premium bonds, I ask the same thing, but look, really, is it worth having them?
Yeah, I mean, the writing's been on the wall for a while. They've been quite high in terms of comparing it to what the only thing you can kind of vaguely compare premium bonds to, which is easy access accounts. And they've been quite competitive rates. People have been pouring money into them. But the underlying prize rate is changing from April. So there's a draw on Monday, on the 2nd of March. And that has a 3.6% underlying rate, and each £1 bond has a 22,000-to-1 odd of a chance of winning. That is going to fall back to 3.3% from the April draw, and each £1 prize will go to 23,000-to-1. It also means that some of the big prizes have been cut back somewhat. So, for example, there were 78 £100,000 prizes in the most recent draw. That's going to fall to 71. There was 143 prizes worth 50 grand. There was 154, and it's going to fall to 143. Lots of people like the idea of being able to win one of those big sums. And the £1 million, of course, that's not changing. That's still two prizes each month. Are they worth still holding? Definitely. I think so. But as part of a balanced suite of finances, you know, you should not just have all of your money parked in premium bonds. And I think you have to kind of evaluate what percentage you want, because the allowance for premium bonds is £50,000. It's very generous, really. But, and a lot of the big prizes, of course, get scooped by people that are maxing out their premium bonds. And there's quite a lot of Britons who like premium bonds and have maxed them out, and would probably be benefit from spreading it about a bit and putting it elsewhere, because you're not guaranteed to win. You know, these are average odds, 3.3%. You might not necessarily win anything, but people just like that notion of being sort of in it to win it. You're not going to lose your stake. And I'm not going to be putting my money out of premium bonds, but only a small percentage of my savings investments are in it. And actually, just to, while we're on the same thread and talking about Easy Access, there was an Easy Access account launched today from Coventry Building Society, which is a best buy rate of 4.25%. Just in comparison to this premium bonds, you know, if you were looking for a new home to stick some of your cash in, you just do still want it in Easy Access. That 4.25% rate is a rare beast, in which it can be opened online and in branch, post, phone, all of the methods, which is quite rare these days. But it's one thing I'll point out, it's not strictly Easy Access. You're only allowed to withdraw from it 3 times a year, but it's unlikely that anyone has money in premium bonds that they withdraw 3 times a year. People like to just park their cash in it and hope for the best. Fingers crossed, get to that start of the month and hoping that they're going to win something big. But yeah, it's definitely one of those moves where you want to reevaluate where you've got your money and whether it's still beneficial.
Or how much.
And how much, exactly.
Yeah. I sold out of mine because I actually used it for a deposit for a house. But I do miss the monthly, like,
the thrill.
Exactly. Oh, come on, 25 quid. I'm rich.
Stick a 50 quid in there. You can still feel like you're part of it. And actually, just to go back to what you said, it is a favourite for grandparents and relatives. And they've made it easier, you know, to be able to stick money into accounts for children and whatnot. I still think a junior ISA is the better option, because if you are putting in piecemeal small amounts into premium bonds, it's very unlikely you're going to win anything.
Yeah, exactly. All right, then. Something about government departments and going digital that makes me a little bit nervous. But there's an interesting article from your senior reporter, Ed Magnus. Hundreds of thousands of taxpayers are just 7 weeks away from a major tax shakeup that could plunge their finances into chaos. Goodness me, that sounds dramatic. Making tax digital is HMRC's big change to the way that property owners, the self-employed, sole traders all report their income and expenses. Now, over the next 2 years, almost 3 million people will be affected. But tax experts are warning that the overhaul is little understood and that many are just blissfully unaware of the upcoming changes, which I can't believe when I read this. I mean, I've heard about making tax digital for some time. I didn't realise I first heard about it from George Osborne in 2015. Wow. So, Simon, what is making tax digital? What does it want to achieve? Why has it been going on for so long?
Making tax digital is not doing your tax return on the gov.uk website, which many people would think they have already made their tax digital from doing that. They put in the details, it tells them how much tax they owe, never quite explains how the number was arrived at in a way that you can actually challenge it. Always seems to be that you owe more than you thought you would have done, and then you have to front up the cash, and it's all done online, which, as I said, many would consider to be digital. Making tax digital, however, is basically introducing a sweeping overhaul, which means that rather than doing the tax returns once a year, people who are affected by this will be doing them 5 times a year. And if they're registered for VAT, it might be 9 times a year.
Oh, my God. Simon, look, a million people, I think, were late on their self-assessment this year alone?
Yeah, yes. And the problem with this, well, there were a number of problems with this. It is that many people affected are blissfully unaware of it until it hits them right in the face, and then they're going to be really annoyed. Secondly, many of the people affected by it are probably quite busy doing things like running small businesses and being entrepreneurs and sole traders, like fixing people's boilers. Plumbers are going to be affected by this. Coming around to deal with your lights. Electricians are going to be affected by this. Building houses. Builders are affected by this. You know, the list goes on. And also that they are going to have to use specialist software to do it. So basically what's going on is you're going to have to do these returns multiple times a year. You're not going to have to pay your tax bill that many times. The idea is it keeps a kind of running tally rather than there being this one and done thing once a year. And I can see the logic behind that. Mm. I could probably see more logic behind it if you were also making running payments, which would probably be quite unpopular, but actually from a financial point of view,
better
would
yeah.
make sense for people because, like, you're self-employed, okay?
Exactly.
I'm right in saying that one of the places where people often get caught out when they're self-employed is at the end of the year when they're like, oh my God, I've got to pay this, all my mm-hmm. tax in one go. Actually, you pay twice, mm-hmm. don't you? Because you pay on account as well.
Yeah.
I don't think the system works very well for a lot of people in terms of kind of planning ahead and cash management and things like that. But the other issue is this kind of software thing. It's like you're not just going to be able to go do this on the gov.uk site, which I think if that was the case, then this would be okay. But it's not. You're going to have to either use an accountant or you're going to have to use professional software. Now, mm-hmm. almost all of this software you pay a fee for. Some of it offers fee-free trial periods. People may have noticed that the thing about fee-free trial periods is at the end of the trial period, they stop being fee-free. And also, once you're locked into some of these services, the fees seem to go up by quite a bit. I know my wife is self-employed. She uses Xero. When she started using Xero, Xero was really cheap for her. She now pays quite a lot of money for Xero, for example. There are some free options, and the government is saying there's going to be more free options. I don't know how good those free options are. We're actually going to have a column from Heather Rogers, our tax expert, who's going to talk us through a few of them coming up soon. I mean, the problem with free options versus the ones that you pay for is sometimes you get what you pay for. Some would consider that we are already paying for the tax system through our taxes. That there's actually, if you look at the gov.uk tax system, it's, beyond the bit where it spits out a number that you're like, how, what? The calculation bit actually works pretty well, So why didn't they build this into there? And so it's going to affect from April people with gross income above £50,000. So that's about 900,000 people. From the next mm-hmm. April, that's going to step down to above £30,000. So that's about another 1.1 million. And then from the next April after that, it's going to be £20,000. So that's about another million. And there is a plan to keep this going further and further down the scale. So you will get to the point where things like community groups and stuff like that are going to get hit. And this is one of the concerns. People with like small neighborhood associations and stuff like that might end up getting caught out by this and having to pay accountants fees and having all of the money that they raise each year just going out on accountancy fees because they're so worried about getting things wrong. And the other issue here is that those numbers are gross income. They're not your profits. So, for example, it's quite easy to hit those numbers. You don't have to be making 50 grand a year yourself as a sole trader mm-hmm. in your profits. You just need to be having gross income of that. So, for example, you could very much see how a plumber, an electrician, someone like that might hit that number, but they're actually making much less money. Well, probably not plumbers and electricians. They're probably making more money, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. As someone who does VAT, I'm crying inside here, Simon, because you mentioned there about small sort of community businesses and whatnot. You just want to be getting on with your job, don't you? And I just checked how much I was paying. So I have Xero as well. It's £48 a quarter. And then I have an accountant. And I was reading the story thinking, I mean, look, I'm a big fan of my accountant. She's lovely. But I feel like they will benefit greatly from things like this. And I thought the point of this was to try and make it easier for us and easier to do our jobs. And I just kind of feel a bit about it as someone who's the dreaded email I get every quarter is, time to do your VAT, Georgie. Any more of that? I can't handle it. Right, Lee, can you really save money switching to an electric vehicle? Let's shut this debate down once and for all. Is
that
it just
the worst segue ever?
I know. Well,
you sounded
I
didn't even so bother
with No. Look, hang on a minute. I'm going to step in here. I'm just going to step in and point out that our esteemed host, who is absolute gold dust at this stuff, usually missed a absolutely unbelievable, obvious segue, which is, with Making Tax Digital, when you get things wrong, there's going to be penalty points. And it's going to be like the ones you get when you're driving, okay? A certain number of points, you then get a fine and you get in trouble. Moving on to electric cars.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, Simon, I've had neither penalties from HMRC nor for driving, so it wouldn't come into my mind,
Goody two shoes over there.
And besides, sometimes, Lee, you just need to park something.
This is more like it. This is electrifying, right, Georgie.
Guys, people are listening to this. They've got other things to do. Can somebody put their foot down on the accelerator and move things on a bit?
Simon. Right. All right, then. Fine. I will do that. Right. Lee, I've asked you the question. Is this just a moral decision and actually you'll end up paying more and you're going to just be racked with range anxiety and trying to find somewhere to charge? With all the finances laid out on the table, which is genuinely the cheapest option right now, just when we talk about the expenses of a car, as it were, I'm crying because I've just paid £1,500 for my absolute piece of rubbish out there to pass its MOT. Crying inside here. What elements are we talking about when we talk about how expensive a car is? I mean, obviously, upfront costs.
I think that before I go on to that, range anxiety, I think now is not the crucial part of what people are worried about electric car ownership. I think that electric car ownership, and I'm talking about people that can have a charging point installed at home, not people that can't do the charging on their driveway. I think it's not really the hugest issue now because lots of cars are coming out with quite big ranges. All of the infrastructure, while not perfect, is improving somewhat. I think what the actual kind of crux of this is and what you're talking about here is the different, it's balancing the different costs and the things that are coming up. So, for example, the pay per mile sort of system that is meant to be coming in a couple of years' time, you know, it's put a lot of people off. It's put a massive spanner in the works because part of the benefit previously of EV ownership was you kind of sidestep that kind of tax. But of course, the Treasury are seeing that there's going to be a huge gap that needs to be filled for fuel duty and is opting for this measure, you know, in order to kind of fill the coffers that way. But the things you're going to want to consider if you're going for an electric car, alongside the pay per mile thing, and if you're happy with that and if all the maths add up, is first of all, as you say, the purchase price. So the actual price that you're going to be paying at the dealership to drive it away. And what this study has done, this study is Boyle Express. What it's kind of showing here is that there is quite a vast gap between petrol and EV equivalents on the whole. So for example, I always use the Vauxhall Corsa because it's such an entry level car for most, and the fact that there's no Ford Fiesta anymore. So the petrol Corsa starts from £21,955. The electric Corsa starts from £27,505. Then you need to factor in how much depreciation that car might have. So that classic thing of, this is how much money it's going to lose when you drive it off the forecourt, which I can't bear. What other purchases do we make? You know, you're just going to drive off of a forecourt and all of a sudden it's worth half the price. It's such a bizarre notion. It really gets to me. Anyway, value loss on the petrol Corsa, according to Auto Express, £11,605. On the electric Corsa, £18,379. That's quite big. It works out servicing. So that's the next thing you're going to want to be thinking about. Servicing on the petrol car over that 3-year period, let's say that's value loss over the 3-year period, not when you just drive it off the forecourt. Servicing over 3 years, £986 for petrol versus just £283 for the EV. Insurance is broadly the same, but we did do a story this week warning that there are some electric cars, especially Chinese electric cars, that insurers just aren't insuring at the moment because there's a lack of knowledge about them and a lack of knowledge of where spare parts and components are coming from. VED is now the same, £390 each. And then looking at how much you're actually going to pay in the fuel. So for petrol, they're talking here or over 30, talk about 36,000 miles driven over these 3 years. It's quite a high amount. Lots of people do under that. But anyway, £4,283 on petrol, £1,314 for electric. You again, that's for charging, you know, probably at the lower end rather than at an expensive end, you know, kind of out and about. But I think a lot of people know that already. Like a lot of people know that it's going to be more expensive. And also those EV model prices I gave you are with any applicable grants as well. I should point that out. Anyway, for the Corsa, it works out that the cost to own the petrol version, £18,913 for the EV, is actually £22,000. And it's done four other popular cars. So the Puma, the EV versus petrol, actually comes out broadly similar. Golf, the EV slightly more expensive over that three-year period versus the petrol. There's a Skoda Karoq, which is actually what I drive, versus the EV version, which is the Skoda Elroq. It's actually far cheaper to have the EV version of that, which I kind of felt a little bit sad reading that. And then again, I saw the price of a new Karoq here, £35,740. I could tell you when I bought our Karoq brand new 7 years ago, it was vastly cheaper than that. Shows you the inflation on some of these car prices now. And then a little bit more of a higher end BMW. You've got a petrol version of the 420i Grand Coupe M Sport. £46,915 is the price for that one. An EV version, and they've picked the BMW i4 eDrive 35 M Sport, catchy, £52,870. You add all of that up, it is saying that the petrol version of the car is £5,000 cheaper to own over 3 years,
right,
versus the EV. So any electric car that you are tempted to buy, you're going to want to compare to how much ownership it's going to cost of petrol, and how long you are planning to have this car. And Simon's going to be better at explaining this. It still is quite hugely beneficial, I believe, to get an EV through work if your company allow it. And he'll be much better at explaining that. But you want to be thinking about all of these different bits of ownership. I haven't made the switch to an EV, mainly because when I bought my Skoda 7 years ago, I decided that I was going to have it for at least 10 years. And that's kind of firmly what's been the plan. I am quite tempted by the Renault 5. EV. It's the only one I've been tempted by, but it seems like half of Britain have also been tempted by that one because there's quite a big wait in this to get one. Also, sporty kind of hatchback, probably not the ideal car for a family with two children, buggy, and a wife that treats the car like an extended bedroom of the house, full of clothes and bits and bobs. Really don't think the Renault 5 is going to cut it. But you want to just sit down and not kind of, I think it's just a sensible thought discussion and sketching out numbers on the back of a pad and figuring out the cost of things. And let's not forget, at the moment petrol is quite cheap compared to where it has been in previous years, and the price of a liter of unleaded I'm talking about here, you know, fluctuations could go up again at some point. I think it's at the cheapest level for about 2 or 3 years, something like that. It's definitely paying around about 130 a liter around here, so that could change. But then so can the price of electricity. So that can change. And sometimes they go in tandem.
Don't we know it?
Think about, you know, it is a lot to think about. Firstly speaking, I think if I was in the market for a car at the moment, I'd probably buy a petrol kind of three-year-old-ish car. Is probably the plum point. EVs are improving though, and there are people that are very happy with their EVs. And we do get emails and people very sensibly give us the data, the numbers, and that they're saving money with an EV, typically if they're charging at home, typically if it's not like high use, so more sort of like used as a runabout. That's a very, 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 very broad rule of thumb.
I'm the same as you, Lee. If I was to buy a new car at the moment, I would probably go for a petrol as well. And as much as you say that range anxiety in reality may not be an issue, I do think there's a legacy narrative around it that will still be putting people off, I think, because I'm still thinking about it. Also, there's nowhere to really charge up where I am at the moment. But also, I was thinking of running my Vauxhall Mokka into the ground for 10 years. I don't think it's going to last, Lee. We've got to 8 years, and I think that's quite an achievement for it. Bless it. Simon, your views?
You can run an electric car incredibly cheaply if, as Lee said, you're charging at home all the time, particularly if you've got solar panels and a you know, what they call an agile energy tariff. So you're charging at the cheapest possible times. And you're not doing those kind of big motorway miles and then filling up on the motorway, because like with petrol, filling up on the motorway is expensive if you need to charge your car on the move. The salary sacrifice work thing that Lee mentioned, involves buying an electric car. You're not technically buying it. You're leasing it effectively through a work salary sacrifice scheme. And then you can not pay tax on those monthly payments. You can save the tax, you can save the national insurance. There is a small charge to claw back a little bit of the saving, but because electric cars are considered to be a good thing, it's a very, very small charge, and it's very, very tax efficient, and so tax efficient and so popular that it's having an impact on secondhand EV prices. Those three-year-old secondhand EVs are so cheap because basically if you can salary sacrifice one, the cost is comparable.
Simon, thank you very much. It's now time for your stat of the week.
37 and 42. Mm-hmm. These are the lottery numbers that have been drawn the most since the lotto changed to 1 to 59 from 1 to 49 on the 10th of October 2015. Each of those has appeared 127 times, followed by 52. Mm-hmm. 126 times, 39 and 58, picked 125 times each. Finally, 11 is the sixth most drawn number.
What's the lowest?
The unluckiest numbers are 21, 26, 30, 44, 48, 55.
All right. Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you, Lee. And thank you for listening. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or any car-related puns you want to share with us, Simon?
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Tell us about your experience of owning an electric car, if you own one, and how cheap you have managed to make it. If you are someone who has managed to make running an electric car unbelievably cheap, we would love to hear from you. Also, any stories of companies that were on the brink of, you know, going bust that you bought into the shares and made stonking great gains on, tell us about those. We'd love to hear them.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.